Welcome to another episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance and blockchain and helps you to understand the emerging trends in digital assets and money. And today there is another episode where I will talk alone for myself and give you a little bit of an insight into how I see the stablecoin industry emerging. So we're going to cover a little bit of explanatory session today. I'm going to cover three parts. The first one is what are stablecoins and how do they differ to accounts? So money sitting in accounts at banks or also other fintechs like payment service providers or e-money institutions. Then after that, we're going to look into the emerging use cases in payments, in the payments use case of stablecoins. And then last but not least, I'm going to also talk a little bit about hurdles that still need to be overcome in order to make stablecoins really a new form of money and payments in the traditional payment space. So without further ado, let's start directly and jump into the first section, and the section on what stablecoins actually are. So what does stablecoin, or what makes them unique ultimately? I think when you compare stablecoins, which are now a regulated form of fiat money on blockchains, right? So it's not anymore, like we were talking or explaining them in the past, a cryptocurrency that is back to some money. No, as per the recent regulatory clarity in Europe, in Japan and Singapore, but now also in the US, stablecoins have really gotten into the regulated sphere of traditional fiat money, and in this case, traditional fiat money on blockchains. But what does it make it so special, or what is the unique characteristic of stablecoins? It's a bearer instrument. So what does that mean? So when we think about what money is, we know that there are different forms of money, public money, private money, and the only bearer instrument form of money, as we know, is public money in the form of physical cash. So it's bills and ultimately also coins. And this physical cash can be held by anybody and also can be remitted or exchanged between any intermediary. And that is what constitutes a bearer instrument, right? So anybody can hold it and I can give it to you when we are physically next to each other without any intermediary. And that is now also possible with digital money, which was not the case beforehand. Bearer instruments usually use a blacklist approach, meaning anybody can hold it besides those that are on the blacklist. Whereas account-based money, so the traditional form of digital money that we use for years or decades, uses a whitelist approach. So ultimately only those that are on the whitelist, only those that can actually hold this type of money, and ultimately which have an account with the issuer of the money, so this could be a bank or a fintech or a payment service provider, an e-money institute, can hold this money, right? And that is the fundamental difference to me, what stablecoins are. They're a digital form of bearer instruments. How does that now compare to especially deposits sitting in a bank account? Or also, let's think about PayPal or Venmo or GrabPay balance. So as long as the customers have pre-funded balance in those accounts, and both customers, or both the sender and the beneficiary, are customers of that issuer, it's basically the same, right? So you can say it's book-to-book transfers in the books of the issuer. So to make it more concrete, if I am with Citibank and my beneficiary that I want to send the money to is also with Citibank, it's a liability swap in the balance sheet of Citi. There's no asset movement. So ultimately, we can both hold Citi money, Citi deposits, and that is true also for PayPal balance. If both are customer of PayPal and can hold PayPal balance, then it's also a liability swap in the balance sheet of PayPal. And this was always the case, right? Because you had to be the customer of the issuer in order to hold balances in that particular money that was issued by the customer. With banks, obviously there's not only Citibank, or there's not only one bank. So if you want to transfer funds to another bank, you have to settle that transaction in central bank money. So central bank money is very important with regards to deposits, And with electronic money, this is usually not possible. So with electronic money, as that, for example, Venmo balance or PayPal balance or whatever, it's really a closed loop system around the issuer. So only the customers of that particular issuer can hold this money. And there's no way to move from PayPal to any other electronic money institute like GrabPay in Singapore or Venmo in the US or any other comparable electronic money in Europe. So therefore, you see, electronic money has always been a closed loop system around the issuer, whereas deposits with a bank have always been multi-bank enabled by settlement in central bank money. And here now comes stablecoins as a completely new form of money that is issued as a bearer instrument, so anybody that is not on the blacklist can hold this liability. And ultimately, it's also a closed loop system around the issuer, right? So you still settle in the liability of the issuer, but on open rails, meaning if you have a wallet that is compatible with the token smart contract standard that the stablecoin issuer uses, for example, an ERC-20 standard, then you can hold balance in that token smart contract and therefore hold this stablecoin, right? So that allows basically worldwide adoption, because these stablecoins are issued on open rails, so an internet protocol, basically on a public permissionless blockchain network, where anybody now can hold this stablecoin if he or she is not on the blacklist. And that is a completely new feature, that is a completely new way to issue money, right? Especially given the permissionless infrastructure on which it is issued. The last point that I want to mention here, what stablecoins makes themselves unique, is also this technical layer, the permissionless infrastructure, right? So anybody that is connected to that blockchain can hold it. And usually smart contracts are also permissionless, meaning anybody can hold balance in that smart contract. That is also possible to restrict, right? So you can also issue a whitelist enabled stablecoin on a permissionless infrastructure, meaning anybody can engage with that infrastructure, can connect to public Ethereum, for example, or Solana, but then needs to be on a whitelist to hold the balance in the token smart contract. That is also possible, right? And so there's nuances to different types of stablecoins. However, the stablecoins that we currently see, USDT from Tether and USDC from Circle, they are also permissionless on the smart contract level. Yeah, so I hope that was clear. I think there's a clear difference to account-based money, how we currently have it or how we have had it over decades. And that makes stablecoins so unique and so special. Now, let's jump to the next piece, which is regulation and the umbrella of what stablecoins are. So really, it's new forms of digital money on blockchain. I wouldn't really call them anymore cryptocurrency backed by money or linked to money. Well, they have become money, right? But this regulation is not yet everywhere. But we see a continued trend around the world to regulate stablecoin issuers and to bring them into the regulatory compliant money framework, so to say. Now, also in the US, Genius Act has been finalized and has been voted in. Now it's time to consolidate it with the Stable Act from the Senate or make the Senate to adopt the Genius Act. So it's not yet completely final, but we're on a very good path. And who can issue these stablecoins? Well, either non-banks that have licenses and have to back their liabilities by bank deposits and high-quality liquid assets like short-term government bonds, but potentially also banks in the future, right? So we've seen now also over the last days, JP Morgan, they've announced that they also want to issue a deposit token on a blockchain. It's not necessarily a permissionless stablecoin as we know it. It is issued on a permissionless infrastructure, but on the smart contract level, it still uses a whitelist approach, meaning it's rather an account on a permissionless infrastructure, similar to how it had already issued their old BDA infrastructure, their blockchain deposit account infrastructure, formerly it was called JP Morgan Coin, on a permissioned infrastructure. Now they do the same on a permissionless infrastructure. So I wouldn't consider that necessarily as a stable coin, but rather a deposit token. But yeah, also under many regulations, banks can, at least in theory, issue also permissionless stable coins on permissionless infrastructure. But yeah, in general, you have to be a licensed institute to issue these stablecoins. And last but not least, many regulations foresee that stablecoins must be non-yield bearing, which means they must not pay interest. And that is a strong restriction, right? So when you think about what money is, it has different features. One is the store of value, which means that you want to hold the funds as well. And if it doesn't pay yield, but other forms of money pay yield, for example, deposits, then it might not be a quite attractive store of value. And we're going to come back to that with regards to the payments use cases, especially when talking about corporates that have an interest in yield-generating assets. So that makes it quite attractive only for specific use cases, which might be the payments use case as a medium of exchange, right? So for example, we've seen the majority of the use cases, and it is still the case in crypto, in the crypto industry, where then it has certain characteristics which is interesting, which is useful, which is payments and settlement of crypto transactions, where, for example, trading takes place of cryptocurrencies. Another characteristic where non-yield bearing characteristic might not matter too much is to hold US dollars. Yeah, so to hold the currency that it represents, and 99.9% are still US dollar denominated. And this might be true for those users in countries where there's very inflationary currency that actually have an interest to hold US dollars. And therefore, potentially the non-yield bearing characteristic might not even matter too much because the user is so much interested in holding US dollars. And interestingly enough, still some initiatives pay yield. So for example, PayPal balances in PYUSD at PayPal. So in the stablecoin of PayPal, at PayPal, they pay yield. There's also this initiative Global USD, where at Kraken you can earn the risk-free rate. Ethana is also a project, which is more like a crypto stablecoin. It's not backed by off-chain assets, so deposits or high-quality liquid assets. And a couple of other examples, but to me it remains a bit unclear whether they will still be under the new regulations emerging around the world that foresee stablecoins not to be yield-bearing, whether they can actually still pay yield. And on the other hand, deposit tokens, they can bear yield as they are regulated differently. Again, not as stablecoins necessarily, but rather as deposits. So there is going to be an interesting development going forward quite surely between stablecoins and regulated under the stablecoin regimes that must not pay interest, but then also new forms of money like deposit tokens or clearly also tokenized money market funds where you might be able to swap very easily into from a stablecoin that then can also bear yield. Yeah, and to wrap this section up before we dive into the use cases, I quickly also want to remind ourselves about the market characteristica of stablecoins. There are two major issuers, Tether USDT and Circles USDC, and they make up 87% of the market cap. Tether 62% of the market cap with roughly $150 billion outstanding, and USDC from Circle with 25%, so a quarter of the market cap, with $61 billion outstanding. And the volume is also quite interesting. So the two stablecoins together have a monthly, over the last 30 days, monthly volume of roughly $2.4 trillion, which is mostly off-chain crypto trading and at centralized exchanges, but then clearly also some on-chain transactions in DeFi. And the behemoth is clearly Tether, so USDT with 2.2 trillion of the 2.4 trillion in 30-day volume. Circle only 240 billion, which is roughly 11% of the volume of Tether. Yeah, so predominantly Tether volume and 150 versus 60 billion stablecoin outstanding, Tether versus USDC. And 99.9% is US dollar denominated stablecoins. So it's really about US dollars at the moment. The second biggest currency is euros, but negligible in comparison to US dollar. Okay, so this was the section on what are stablecoins. Again, to remind each other how they differ from the existing digital money that we use, which is account-based money, traditional deposits at banks, and also electronic money balances. And then the regulation, the non-yield bearing nature and the market characteristic that we've talked about. Now let's jump into the use cases of stablecoins. And as stated already, the major use case was and still is crypto trading. Yeah, so we've seen the volume, 2.4 trillion, the majority of it is in crypto trading, and it is about trading on centralized exchanges, but then also some other crypto transactions in DeFi. So decentralized borrowing, lending, but clearly also trading on decentralized exchanges. But what everybody is now interested in, and when you go on LinkedIn or in the media, and everybody is now talking again about the payments use cases and how stablecoins will ultimately dethrone banks, well, which payments use cases are we talking about? It's peer-to-peer payments, so predominantly remittances, B2B payments, so businesses to businesses, and also B2C payments, so payouts to citizens, and C to B as well, obviously when some citizens buy something at businesses. Yeah, so classical payments use cases. And there were, over the last weeks, some quite interesting studies that came out that also look into these payments use cases. One is from BCG and the other one is from Artemis and Castle Island Ventures, which both focus or look into the payments use cases. Let's start with the BCG study. And they say roughly 92% of the volume of stablecoins is in crypto, 8% other, with 3% tokenized asset settlement and 5% payments. So it's estimated, the payments use case is estimated to be roughly 100 billion a month. So that is already quite interesting, 100 billion in comparison to the 2.4 trillion. Yeah, it's roughly 5%. And it mentions that study that 10% of cross-border remittances are reported to be settled in stablecoins already. That's an interesting figure there. And also they explain that Bitso, which is a centralized stablecoin payment firm, apparently is already processing up to 10% of remittance volume between Mexico and the US. So there seems to be a corridor where stablecoins are used. And in the other study that I brought with me is the Artemis study and Castle Island Ventures study. They estimate a much smaller number, not 100 billion a month, but rather 6 billion US dollar per month, which would be like only a quarter percent of the 2.4 trillion US dollar of Tether and US dollar, USDC volume. And what they've done is they looked at 20 stablecoin-based payment companies. Bitso was also part of it. But also Binance Pay, Conduit, and others. So major stablecoin payment firms. They say, yes, it's a conservative approach, but they do believe it is a fair representation of the market. And they also use 11 more stablecoin payment companies and look at the on-chain transactions. So in total, 31 payment service providers. It's not all of them, but they again say it's a good overview. And what I like about the study is it really shows also this on-chain data, right? So they basically break down different sectors. So peer-to-peer, B2B, B2C use cases, but then also different geographies. And then also a look at the on-chain data with regards to which infrastructure is being used and also which stablecoin is being used. And not to a surprise, majority is in USDT, so in Tether, and interestingly enough, also majority on Tron, which is a quite high performance blockchain. Second is Ethereum or layer twos on Ethereum, for example, also Polygon, but a major volume is in USDT and Tron. Check out those two studies. I will include them in the show notes, the links to those studies, and they were quite interesting. And what these studies explain, but also when I look at the market, what I see with regards to stablecoin adoption and payments, I can cluster, or I think you can cluster, the initiatives and also the developments into five different segments, which is remittances. Then clearly, as discussed already, providing access to the currency in which stablecoins are denominated, which is US dollars, in countries with high inflation and volatile currencies. Then another area is faster and more efficient B2B and B2C payments, so payouts to remote workers, for example. Then wholesale interbank payments. There's another trend emerging. So settlement between payment institutions and banks, but then also ecosystems around merchants and on payment platforms, right? So let's go through each one of them real quick, and then I give my insights or my overview of how I cluster these different use cases. So remittance, I mean, that's relatively straightforward. In some corridors, apparently, there's already a good adoption as per the BCG study in Mexico and the US, but clearly also in Latin America, in African countries, but also Turkey, it was mentioned, Argentina, and so forth. And it does make sense, right? So let's think about sender and receiver being connected to the blockchain network, having a wallet that can interact with the token smart contract. Then it's a very, very easy transaction in a matter of seconds being sent or the money being sent from one place on Earth to the other place on Earth. The question clearly then is, what do you do with the money, right? And that might lead also to defunding requirements. We're going to come back to that in a minute as well, especially also in other areas. And yeah, let's maybe then also jump into the next area, which is somewhat linked also to the remittance case, which is providing access to a US dollar in countries where the population might actually have a big interest in holding US dollars. And potentially not even as a medium of exchange, but rather also as a store of value, because US dollar is quite stable, and eventually those currencies that they have in their local country are not. But then again, the question comes up, how do you spend them? And this is where we've seen some recent initiatives, again, from MasterCard and Visa to issue cards against stablecoin balances. And we've seen that trend already over the last years, where MasterCard and Visa partnered with crypto exchanges, for example, to provide crypto cards where you could spend crypto, but obviously also stablecoins. But over the last weeks and months, there were many different announcements. So from Stripe and Ramp, for example, with Visa, and a couple of other initiatives where MasterCard and Visa said they cooperate to issue cards where then users can spend their stablecoins. And this is ultimately what makes stablecoin wallets then to become much closer as an alternative to a bank account, because if you have your balance in a wallet but then can also spend it wherever MasterCard and Visa card are accepted, it is becoming somewhat of a bank account, right? Because you can do transactions from wallet to wallet but then also spend it via the merchant networks of MasterCard and Visa. However, on the other hand, if you think about those countries where users might want to hold US dollars eventually, and the infrastructure of MasterCard and Visa is also not that great, right? So you also have to think, obviously, about that fact that, yes, it's great that you can spend those stablecoins with MasterCard and Visa, but obviously the local coffee or the local small shop where you want to buy your stuff also has to accept those payment methods. So that is on the retail side, providing access to US dollars. But then we've also seen announcements of Stripe, for example, also of Nuvei, to allow merchants and companies to hold US dollar stablecoins. And that might also be predominantly interesting now in those countries where also merchants want to hold US dollars. The remittance use case, as discussed already, but also D2C payments might actually not need to off-ramp here in order to spend them, because they actually want to hold US dollars. With merchants, I mean, they might also want to go off-chain then again into the local currency because they need to pay somebody that is not possible via payment in MasterCard and Visa, and therefore you also need to off-ramp into the local currency here. Now, that was the area of providing access to US dollar. The next section that I want to talk about is faster and more efficient B2C and B2B payments. And we've seen also by Stripe, for example, but also WorldPay, a recent announcement in the B2C area, where we already also see some traction, as described also in the studies of Artemis and BCG. But here, Stripe payouts, WorldPay also allows it, basically enable those users that use Stripe or WorldPay to get the money to gig workers, tech developers, and so forth that live abroad much easier, right? So it's a more efficient payout mechanism. And actually, in these countries, potentially those beneficiaries actually want to hold US dollars as well, and then eventually spend them via MasterCard or Visa, right? So in this B2C use case, there is also potentially not the need, as just described, to off-ramp if they can spend this money there with MasterCard and Visa, or actually want to hold US dollars. In the B2B area, this looks a bit different, I would say, right? Differently. And we've seen, obviously, announcement over the last months already, for example, from SAP with their digital currency hub, where they integrate stablecoin payments in the SAP ERP. And putting the recent episode with SAP also again into the show notes if you are interested in our discussion with SAP on the digital currency hub. But in B2B payments, I would expect more that you actually also have to off-ramp into the stablecoin. And this is what is referred to as the stablecoin sandwich, because usually also business might not hold stablecoins. So therefore, they first have to efficiently on-ramp into the stablecoin, then use it as a means of payment to receive the beneficiary, which is another business. And then this business might actually also not want to hold stablecoins because they are not yield-bearing. And then they have to off-ramp from the stablecoin to their traditional deposits at a bank. So there you need a very efficient off-ramping infrastructure, as many businesses, especially those that use SAP, which is a sophisticated ERP, which is not that cheap and sophisticated to implement. And I think the correlation is quite high that those corporates that use SAP also have an interest to earn yield. So therefore, the off-ramping infrastructure is required, which is not yet there globally, at least also in an efficient and also higher value way. Also, one other piece that I want to highlight is stablecoins are usually at the moment single payments, right? So there's no way to sign bulk transactions in stablecoins. So you also have to think about which corporate actually does individual transactions, so single transactions. Usually, again, corporates might load or upload bulk files to their banks via their B2B transactions or for their B2B transactions, and therefore not necessarily instruct single payments. But with stablecoins, this is still the case, right? But definitely interesting that also now SAP is looking into that space to allow B2B transactions also in stablecoins. Predominantly focusing clearly on cross-border payments, right? But then again, the off-ramping might become needed. And the same holds true also for the next area, which is, I think, wholesale interbank payments, where we've also seen recent news and initiatives, predominantly the CPN, the Circle Payments Network, which ultimately also aims to provide a settlement asset for interbank or inter-PSP transactions. And the nature of this is predominantly also then a stablecoin sandwich, where you would first have to on-ramp, but then eventually also off-ramp, because the bank that uses Circle's stablecoin or other PSPs eventually as well might not want to hold a non-yield-bearing asset. So that also requires the off-ramping. And then here in this case, eventually even in much higher values, because usually in the wholesale space, transactions can also become quite high. One interesting piece about this CPN initiative is that it might actually also allow stablecoin payment providers, and you can check the CPN is now live on the press release or on the website. Ultimately, you can see which stablecoin payment firms also now want to adopt the CPN for settlement. And eventually, these stablecoin firms might not even get a bank account due to the risk appetite of that particular bank. And now, due to CPN, they actually have an alternative. They can use also regulated forms of money, which is stablecoins, to settle between each other, but now don't need to do that with a bank, but can do that with Circle. And Circle therefore becomes their settlement bank, you could argue, right? Or provides the settlement asset, and they settle in a liability of Circle and not anymore in a liability of, let's say, JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, Citibank, whatever. So interesting development here in this wholesale interbank space as well. And the last use case that I see emerging over the last weeks and months is also to provide ecosystems around merchants and payment platforms. So you've seen the announcement potentially from Ant Financial. There were also announcements from Walmart or Amazon especially. And that is the idea of them either using existing stablecoins or potentially even also issuing their own stablecoin and therefore become more independent from banking rails, right? And let's think about a use case where on the merchant platforms that use Ant Financial's infrastructure or also obviously Amazon, the users, so the retail users, are incentivized to hold stablecoins. Well, that might become very profitable for the issuer. So that's why Ant Financial and apparently also Amazon, Walmart are looking also into issuing stablecoins. Why is that attractive? Well, they are non-yield bearing, right? So you are not allowed to pay interest on your liability, but have assets that are yield bearing. And that makes stablecoin issuance so profitable. So when you look at Tether's recent revenue figures over the last years, ultimately also, Tether is really the most profitable company in the world. I think with $13 billion revenue last year, with only like 50 to 100 employees, right? So it's incredibly profitable. Again, very easily because you have liabilities that you don't need to pay yield on. But on the asset side, you receive the yield. So therefore, those players are looking into that. They could provide incentives to retail users to hold the stablecoin, but then also potentially for merchants to receive payments in stablecoins as well, therefore building this closed loop around stablecoins without having to go through bank payment rails again. Obviously, also, you have to on-ramp, you have to off-ramp whenever the merchant also wants to pay somebody that does not accept stablecoins. But nevertheless, you can, on the spectrum of only using bank money to only using stablecoins, move into the direction of stablecoins. So those were the five use cases that I see emerging with regards to payments use cases using stablecoins. I hope that made sense for you as well. So remittance, providing US dollar access in some countries where there's inflation and volatile currencies, then faster and more efficient B2B and B2C use cases where we see now then also more dependency on and off ramping, especially off ramping predominantly, then wholesale interbank space where this is also true, and then the ecosystems around merchant and payment platforms. Now, in the reminder of this episode, I also want to talk about hurdles that I believe need to be overcome in order to strengthen the role of stablecoins in traditional payments much more. Because we still see that it is a niche business. As we discussed, the volume of payments in stablecoins is still quite low, even though I expect a strong growth in that area. But in order to accelerate that growth, I think the hurdles that I'm not going to talk about, now going to talk about, need to be overcome, which is predominantly to me infrastructure hurdles, right? So first of all, it's the stablecoin sandwich issue. You have to go very efficiently into stablecoins, but then also be able to go out again from stablecoins into bank deposits. Because on the sending side, on the on-ramping side, users usually don't hold stablecoins and therefore need a very efficient on-ramping. And depending on the use case, again, they might not want to hold stablecoins. You also need a very efficient off-ramping. And especially that must also be true in these, when you think about cross-border payments as use cases, in these developing countries where you actually might want to then off-ramp and where the beneficiary sits if they don't only want to hold US dollars in the form of stablecoins that are non-yield bearing. And the costs to on and off ramping, they obviously also need to be smaller or lower than the cost to send money via traditional rails. And to make stablecoins then more efficient, the on and off ramping, but potentially also the FX costs, which might also not be as good as in traditional markets, right? Because it is a newly emerging market where the margins are still much higher. And then also the transaction fees that you have to pay to the intermediary that offers the service, also the on-chain transaction fees. All these three must be lower than the fees on traditional ways. And there are some studies and there's some research coming up that argues that this is not yet necessarily the case, yeah? Because you also need to have very, very liquid markets for on and off ramping, especially also then off ramping in those countries where you want to use the stablecoin as a medium of exchange. Yeah? So yeah, the on and off ramping infrastructure is hugely important. And this, I think, is not yet well developed so far. But clearly, this will develop over time. And we will see whether that leads to even more widespread adoption of stablecoins and payments. The other infrastructure requirement that I see is to become compliant with the travel rule. Yeah, so you have to ensure regulatory informations that are required in order to become compliant are sent with the stablecoin. But that's not going to happen on the blockchain itself because you don't want to have all this information on a tamper-proof and ultimately an undisputable and unchangeable infrastructure. But that requires another messaging layer on top. So in traditional payments, this is done by SWIFT, right? SWIFT also ultimately moves the money, you could say, which is not necessarily true because the money just resides in the databases in each of the different banks, and they use SWIFT in order to debit and credit those databases, those centralized account databases. Here you have a stablecoin that can basically move on blockchains, but you still need to have this messaging layer, which might become SWIFT. So far there's no strong development in using SWIFT, but rather two other vendors or to other solutions, which is Trust or also Nota Bene. But in order to move stablecoins in a compliant way with the travel rule requirements and the travel rule regulations, at the moment, both the sender and the beneficiary institution, if it is a hosted wallet infrastructure, need to be on the same message layer and message provider, which is either Trust or Nota Bene. If that is not the case, then you can use email, but that is not very scalable, right? So again, also here, we need an industry-wide adoption of those players, of those networks, Nota Bene, Trust, or others, but that is also not yet the case. Then next to the infrastructure hurdles that I see, clearly there's regulatory hurdles that need to be overcome. So we need global regulation and also regulations globally that accept other regulations around the world. Yeah, and to be compliant also and to be harmonized with each other. And then the last piece is dollarization. So we've seen, I use this as also one of the different use cases and trends that I see clearly in the market with the strong focus on Latin America at the moment with stablecoins and payments in African countries and Southeast Asia, the dollarization use case, right? But that obviously also requires that the countries that get dollarized through stablecoins actually accept it, or the regulators or the central bank accepts it. And when you look at the Eurozone, for example, this is one of the key arguments and one of the key reasons why the ECB pushes ahead so strongly with the digital euro project, because they fear, basically, or they argue that there could be a US dollar denominated stablecoins entering the European market, where they want an alternative, which they believe should be the digital euro. I'm not here to argue now in this episode whether that is the right approach, but that is clearly a trend and a reason and a motivation for the ECB to do that. And I expect if there is a strong dollarization now through stablecoins in any of the developing countries or those countries that have not stable currencies, that also the regulator would have an interest in preventing the US dollarization in this country. So it remains to be seen whether that is actually also possible, because ultimately it's a barrier instrument on a permissionless infrastructure, but it might ban intermediaries to offer services, for example, also for off-ramping in these or out of these stablecoins. Yeah. So also on that front, there's still a bit of an unclarity. And these were just a couple of hurdles. There are clearly much more, but to me, these are the most important ones with regards to stablecoin adoption and payments. Yeah, so that was lots of content. I hope you liked that episode. I hope it helped you to understand the recent trends with regards to stablecoin adoption and payments. I would be very happy to hear back from you what you thought about that episode. Make sure you comment on social media, on any of the podcast platforms that you are using. Give us a rating, talk about the podcast if you like it, spread the word, and I would be very happy about that and hearing back from you. This was very likely one of my last episodes that I recorded here from Singapore, as I will return to Germany. So thanks a lot for those listeners also here in Singapore. I will obviously also continue and would be happy if you continued as well. But yeah, as a last goodbye from Singapore, so bye-bye, as they say it here, and thanks for tuning in.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.